Okay, what I'm going to cover this afternoon are, again, if you refer to the questions, the panel questions in your handouts, are urinary health and preventing urinary tract infection in long-term care settings, patient education, and also definition for surveillance, criteria for surveillance, and nurse-driven protocols. So those are the things that I'm going to be covering. Okay, first off, urinary health. I have some numbers here, and some of this were covered earlier. This is just to let you know how urinary tract infection can impact a large number of residents in our long-term care. Currently, more than 1.5 million persons in the United States reside in a nursing home, and the CDC estimates that 1.5 healthcare-associated infection occur in long-term care residents per year. And looking at that, it seems like, you know, you'll have one resident developing infection per year, but that's not so, because there are some who never develop infections. There are some, you know, with chronic infections. And in most surveys, UTI is the leading healthcare-associated infection in long-term care. So if 30 to 35% of total healthcare-associated infections are UTIs, you're looking at maybe 400-some thousands residents in long-term care experiencing urinary tract infection and the other things, you know, that go with that. The prevalence of UTI in long-term care is 15 to 50% in non-catheterized and 90 to 100% in catheterized. And, you know, we've covered a lot on catheterized patient that usually has, you know, the higher risk of developing urinary tract infection. The incidence rate is 1 to 2.4 per 1,000 patient days, and according to Dr. Palmer earlier, that was brought up that, you know, one could have an infection maybe in 3 years, but that's not so. Others, you know, could develop infection less than that time. One of the, as nurses or even different disciplines, social workers, physicians, nurse practitioners, one of the things that near and dear to my heart as a nurse is the effect of urinary tract infection in the quality of life of our residents. I'm not preaching to the choir here. You've observed your residents going through many changes physically, psychosocially, mentally, and even emotionally when they develop urinary tract infection. So we have to consider this. It also affects, you know, their dignity. Actually, I have a personal experience about 2 months ago when my mother developed a very bad urinary tract infection. Right before my eyes, I've seen the changes, you know, that went through covering all these areas of effects of UTI. First off, she fell the week before she had a urinary tract infection. It may or may not be related to the infection because she has vertigo. She gets dizzy, you know, once in a while. So again, that might have played a role, but we were not sure. And then she developed burning and urination, dysuria, pain and urination. And then she became very weak. And with weakness, she has to be dependent. She needs assistance to the bathroom. And even her mental status, she had delirium, she got confused. Psychosocially, she became socially isolated because at one point, in front of everybody, she became incontinent and couldn't hold her bladder and she didn't make it to the bathroom. So again, the impact is like looking at a person, you know, this person who was kind of like normal earlier became a totally person and humiliated, embarrassed, and sometimes, you know, with your residents, you feel their pain. As a family member, you feel more the pain that they go through. So she ended up not eating well. She became dehydrated. that compounded, you know, the symptoms, and she ended up in the emergency room and in dehydration and found out she had severe urinary tract infection. So we have to pay attention to our residents. They need that support from us. They need that understanding from us when they develop this infection. You and I, we may be affected. Maybe at some point you had urinary tract infections in the past, but you go to work, you go, you know, through your normal way of living, but not the residents in the nursing home. They become very independent, you know, for our assistance. So again, that is why it's very important to promote urinary health. Prevention is still the best medicine. Then hospitalization, it was also mentioned earlier, one of the most common transfers to acute care facilities is urinary tract infection. Right now, some nursing facilities are trying to prevent these transfers. They are trying to assess and manage urinary tract infection in facility and treating them in facility, including hydration. And so we can avoid, you know, with urinary health, which I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes, that would really help maybe reduce hospitalization of residents to the hospital. And also cost. Substantial morbidity associated with healthcare-associated infection generates additional healthcare costs. That's common sense. So again, we could reduce healthcare costs by, again, prevention. And staff time. You and I know that if we have somebody with infection, it's more time, you know, for nurses giving medications, more time for CNAs because they need assistance with their ADLs when they go to the bathroom, when they become incontinent, also observation, monitoring, you know, things like those can really increase staff time. And with decreased staffing in the long-term care, you know, that's a big challenge. Okay, let's talk about promoting urinary health. There are three main areas in promoting health. One is regular toileting, another is good personal hygiene, and the third one is hydration. Hydration itself is a very huge area, and CMS spends, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, just for dehydration management. So with regular toileting, nothing new to all of us, make sure they have, you encourage urination or voiding at scheduled intervals and assist the bathroom every 2 hours or when they need it. With good personal hygiene, it was overemphasized earlier, you know, good perineal care. And we have to keep the resident dry and clean if they're incontinent, and we have to check them every 2 hours and change their briefs when necessary. Hydration, this does not only include nursing department, it's an all discipline, all hands-on initiative for all of us, from administrator to physicians to social workers, CNAs, nursing staff, physician assistants, nurse practitioners. Should really be involved. There was an article that even mentioned, you know, state surveyors could be involved in your hydration program where they go visit and interview residents in your facility, ask them to bring some fluids with them during the interview, and that will, you know, promote hydration. So I think that's a good idea. We'll put them to work once in a while. So with hydration, there are a lot of suggestions out there. There are a lot of resources and how you can promote hydration, different programs. And one is fluid rounds. And with fluid rounds, you can even have they call it hydration cart. You know how sometimes you have a walking library. You know, the volunteers will have a cart full of books. You can do the same thing, you know, have a cart, make it colorful, and, you know, put a variety of fluids or juices, whatever, you know, is available in the building, and then make rounds and make that available for the residents. Happy hours. Who would not want happy hours? That's another idea that's going around to promote increased intake. And happy hours, you can even have, you know, some cocktails, non-alcoholic, and, you know, pretend, well, not pretend, but, you know, actually have a bar and they can come up, they can order their drinks. You can have like little, you know, little Hawaiian umbrella or fresh fruit, you know, to garnish, you know, the drink. Make it so attractive to them, because a styrofoam cup of fluid is not so attractive. Even with the mesh resident, it has to be clear container. And tea time, you know, ladies, you want tea time, especially during cold weather. So activities. So when I tell you about all disciplines, activity also has a great role. In their activity programs, they can incorporate the hydration program. For every activity, they can offer fluids, make that available for them all the time. You know, cooking time, they can have a juice bar and, you know, make that available for the residents. Then education. We educate our staff, you know, regarding hydration, the importance of hydration and preventing dehydration and preventing urinary tract infection and orientation and annually or when necessary. When we do surveillance and we find that there is an increase in urinary tract infection in one hallway or in one building, we move forward with re-educating the staff. So with hydration, you have to re-educate them, the importance of it, and how they could accomplish this. Even CNAs, every visit to the room, they may offer drinks, nurses. Sometimes when you go around with nurses, you'll find liquids maybe in, you know, small medication cups sometimes. So it's a good idea to make, to have those 8 ounces glasses available, because if you offer them more fluids, the more they'll drink, okay? So again, that's one of the things that you may do. Other practices, okay, the resident and staff education. You may have a theme. In one of our facilities, they have this big football coolers available for the residents, and it kind of like reminds them about football season. They have those available. Lemonade during the summertime is just so attractive to see, you know, like a cool sliced lemon ice, you know, in a cooler, and, you know, you're ready to drink, especially when it's hot. Popsicles, jellos, make those available also. And other disciplines, so social services, maybe come, we go to a residence room and visit them, have a glass of water with them. So I think it's a good rule of thumb to for everyone, every time they have an interaction with a resident, to offer fluids. We all know that the elderly has a very high risk for dehydration compared to younger persons. And that's because their bodies have lower water content than the younger ones. And a person weighing an elderly who's weighing 150 pounds has 7 liters less water than a younger person, you know, with the same weight. So again, they are very sensitive to hydration, to dehydration. Excuse me. So those are some of the ideas as far as, you know, promoting urinary health through hydration. So the next one is patient education. Do you do patient education in your building? Yes, you do. We always do on a daily basis. Patient education, before we could teach our residents, they're adults, there are principles in educating the adult population. And we have to make sure or understand that they are highly motivated. In general, people learn at different speed, and also we have to keep in mind that we have to use as many senses as you can when you're educating the residents. And there could be challenges in education. Sometimes English is not their first language. They might be speaking another language. So English information handouts may not, you know, may not work. There are some linguistic services that are available that you can use. And also some, there are a lot of resources out there. And also by using all the senses, just for your information, we retain information, 10% of the information of what we see. We retain 10%. We retain 30 to 40% of what we see and hear, and we retain 90% of what we see, hear, and do. So most probably at the end of the day, we are expecting that maybe you'll retain 30% of information that you have heard from us today. So with residents, it's very important. When we get to the video and demonstration and return demonstration, that would really help them a lot, especially when they're going home. If you have to teach them how to do insulin shots, if you have to teach them how to do intermittent catheterization, illustrations, pictures, make sure it's large print, the handouts that you produce, will really help them. Again, back in my personal experience, my mom ended up in the hospital with urinary catheter. And here I am watching every move by the nurses. Are they washing their hands? Are they cleaning, you know, that spigot before they empty the urinary drainage bag? One thing that I could say is that she received excellent care in this hospital, but the patient education was kind of like not as expected. My mom did not know about catheter. I had to educate her. I had to pull, you know, the computer and teach her how to do that. The discharge education plan were just some maybe four bulleted instructions that she has to follow, but nothing with the Foley catheter that she's going home with, and also how to prevent infection. So we have to remember that. Sometimes we take it for granted. We'll say, oh, they know, she knows, but we don't. So that's one thing we have to keep in mind. So handouts that are large print with pictures are very helpful. If you can have maybe a DVD or, you know, YouTube actually has some good information on catheter teaching. Demonstration, return demonstration, if you have to do in and if a gentleman, let's say, for example, needs an in and out catheterization, you may have, you know, a handout, large print, you have to demonstrate. If you have a mannequin, that's excellent, you can do the return demonstration and then do it actually, you know, to himself by observation. Now also, FAQs or frequently asked questions are also very helpful. So yeah, sometimes if you have taught a group for quite some time, you'll get the same questions every time. So developing that FAQs, you know, for the residents will be very helpful. Okay, now here we are for the definition of healthcare-associated infection. In general, healthcare-associated infection is defined as a facility-acquired or facility-associated infection not present or incubating on admission and not manifested in the first 72 hours of admission. So if you are admitting a resident today and tomorrow this person is having a fever, maybe hematuria, or again some of the signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection that were mentioned earlier, that may, and they meet the criteria, that might not be, that is not facility acquired. That is community acquired, or if they come from the hospital, that's hospital acquired. So when you do surveillance in your building, you have to make sure you look at the transfer notes. If it's computerized and you look back in your computer, what does this person go through in the hospital? What did they do? What tests? What treatment? And then you can, you know, go back. Again, after 72 hours, if they develop the symptoms, then that's you own that infection. You don't own it prior to 72 hours. The definition that I'm going to point out to you is very similar to CMS, but actually this is by McGeer. This is a definition that we use for surveillance in long-term care. And for UTI, again, it only includes symptomatic urinary tract infection. Surveillance for a symptomatic infection Surveillance for asymptomatic bacteriuria defined as the presence of a positive urine culture in the absence of new signs and symptoms of urinary tract infection is not recommended, as this represents baseline status for many residents. Going back to statistics, that's about maybe 15 to 40% of men and 25 to 50% of women from Dr. Palmer's presentation. When you do surveillance, infection surveillance in your building, make sure that you have to be consistent, you have to be objective, and you have to stick to this criteria. Especially if you have multiple facilities, you have to be consistent. If you're training different persons doing surveillance in different buildings, you train them yourselves. Just so, you know, for the purpose of consistency. So when you compare them, you know, facility to facility, you will have a valid comparison. And no personal opinion, because sometimes when I talk to the persons who does surveillance in our buildings, sometimes they said, and I think this is really an infection, I would call this an infection. I said, no, you have to go back to your criteria. But the doctor called it, the culture is positive. I said, well, you have to stick to the criteria. So it's a mantra, stick to it. So the criteria that we follow for symptomatic is that you should, one of the following criteria must be met. So there are two. One, this is for the resident who does not have an indwelling urinary catheter. And it has at least three of the following signs and symptoms, very similar to what was covered earlier, except a fever with some variation. Fever of greater or equal to 104 degrees Fahrenheit or chills, new or increased burning pain on urination, frequency and urgency, new flank suprapubic pain or tenderness, change in character of urine, and worsening mental or functional status. A change in the character of urine may be clinical. Mentioned earlier, new onset of bloody urine, foul smell, or increase in the amount of sediment, or as reported by the lab as new pyuria or microscopic hematuria. So that's the definition. And the other is for a resident who has an indwelling catheter, you should have at least two of the following signs and symptoms. Fever equal or greater than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or chills, new flank or suprapubic pain or tenderness, again minus the burning and urination, urgency and all that. Change in the character of urine or worsening of mental or functional status. Now in McGeer definition, I have to read this. It says, in catheterized residents, the most common occult infectious source of fever is the urinary tract. The combination of fever and worsening mental or functional status in such residents meets the criteria for UTI. However, if such residents meet the criteria for infection at a site other than the urinary tract, then it is an infection at the other site. Let's talk about nurse-driven protocols for UTI prevention. Most probably most of you are familiar with bundle approach to infection management, example, urinary tract infections. The bundle concept has been embraced by many organizations. They implement evidence-based changes in their practice, and these changes they incorporate in their standard of practice, and then they perform ongoing or periodic review of progress to reinforce successful strategies. And I'm going to read to you one of the resources that I have come across. There is an example of a ladder bundle. And I apologize, I have to read it. I don't have that on the slides. It's ABCDE, acronym down, not really an acronym, but alphabetical. Aseptic insertion, this is the example of the ladder bundle in one organization. Aseptic insertion and proper maintenance is paramount. B, bladder ultrasound may avoid indwelling catheterization. C, condom or intermittent catheterization in appropriate patients. D, do not use the indwelling catheter unless you must. And E, early removal of the catheter using reminders or stop orders appears warranted. So again, this is just an example. All right, let me just go through this quickly so we won't run out of time. With a bladder scanner, who are currently using bladder scanners in your buildings? That's excellent. Portable scanner usually accurately measure even a relatively small amount of urine. And well, just an intro, we used to use catheterization to check BBRs. Nowadays, it is highly encouraged to use the bladder scan. So again, it could measure, accurately measure even the smallest amount of urine. It reduces the need for urinary catheterization. And with fewer catheterizations, there's fewer introduction of bacteria into the bladder, therefore fewer urinary tract infection. With BBRs, the clinical indications are to assess, again, BBRs to determine urinary retention and need for catheterization. Also, this is used for somebody who's on intermittent catheterization, as mentioned earlier, rather than blindly catheterization or resident, you can check the bladder volume before you even do catheterization to prevent, again, insertion. And also to determine the actual bladder volume in residents who are on scheduled catheterization. Oh, sorry, bullet number two, if you have to remove a catheter, this is a good means to assist them with bladder retraining by determining the need to void after catheter removal. And lastly, I'm not sure if you have implemented this in your building. We have not. To assist staff in implementing a toileting program by determining the amount of urine in the bladder when attempting to toilet a resident. We have not figured out yet, you know, how we due to staff and staffing time constraint, we're not there yet. But we do check it when we remove a Foley catheter. Our protocol is you remove the catheter, you check the resident after 8 hours, the PVR. If PVR is greater or equal than 200, is greater than 200, you catheterize. And we catheterize for 4 days or until the resident voids. Usually they don't reach that fourth day. After a day or two, they start voiding on their own. And that really helps them too. Prevention of catheter-associated urinary tract infection. I'm not going to go through this. We had covered this earlier, but just one big reminder: if you are securing a catheter, I just want to emphasize the wide port is the best place to anchor that catheter to the leg or to the abdomen. And of course, unobstructed urine flow and start with a small bore catheter. Urine specimen collection can really misdiagnose. Improper collection could really misdiagnose or a resident, you know, with urinary tract infection. There are different opportunities where you can contaminate the specimen. First off, is not cleaning, you know, the perineal area. Another is using a contaminated container. Person not washing their hands, either CNAs or nurses. And lastly is storage. You all know the first part of it, so I'm not going to go through that. The last part is storage, because that could really affect overgrowth of bacteria if you leave them in room temperature. Ideally, it should be done, culture should be done within 2 hours, and beyond 2 hours, you know, forget it, it's not a good specimen anymore. So it has to be refrigerated between 36 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit to prevent that overgrowth. or sometimes you can use a preservative to do that. All right, well, thank you very much.